up the borders these days.
The crowd cast questioning eyes on Lorelai, but she didn't hesitate with her response.
Yes, King Zachary is putting the taxes to good use. He is refortifying the wall around Sacca City. He is strengthening the defences of the castle. This will surely protect the people in the rest of Saccharidia from ground mites.
This had to be only half the story, Kerrigan thought. But what if it wasn't? Maybe the Morwellians were right. Maybe Saccharidia did need a new king. But Lorelai Duran did not want a king at all. What would she put in his stead? Herself? Kerrigan shifted in the saddle, guiding the horse toward a sudden opening between some clumps of people. She wasn't ready to side with the Morwellians or Lorelai Duran.
King's folk will protect Saccharidians, shouted another man.
Lorelai met his outburst with laughter.
Like they protected the families on the borders. A whole unit of soldiers was slain down the north road. Is that protection?
The arguments went back and forth for some time, and Lorelai churned the emotions of the audience. She pounded her fist into her hand to add emphasis. She used facial expressions to affect sadness or anger, her voice alternately beseeching and persuasive. She derided all forms of kingdomship, including those who served the king, such as Green Riders, and accused the wealthy class of supporting the tyranny of the king. The merchants walked away amidst jeers. Lorelai was a master performer, and soon she had the crowd waving their fists above their heads and chanting, "A kingless land is a free land! Monarchy is tyranny!" Kerrigan tried to work the horse through the logjam of people, and was cursed at for getting in the way.
"Well, if you let me through," she said, "I'll get out of your way."
In the distance, she espied the wooden bridge that spanned the River Terrigood, which upon crossing would free her from the main portion of the town of North. Then, above the chanting, one voice rang out.
"She's a Green Rider!"
Kerrigan froze. Two men pushed through the crowd and pointed in her direction. Abram's tree poachers. An angry murmur swelled through the crowd, though they couldn't quite figure out who the lumberjacks were pointing at. There was no one dressed in green. Kerrigan had to act fast before the anger of the mob, for mob it was now, turned on her. If they realized who the lumberjacks were pointing at, they would tear her apart. She glanced ahead and saw a woman wearing a light green tunic. It was the burly woman she had seen Clathius giving a card reading to the previous night at the fallen tree. Kerrigan pointed at her and yelled,
"There she is! There's the greenie!"
An expression of bewilderment, then fear, took over the woman's face. As the crowd surged toward her, Kerrigan meandered through the angry people until someone grabbed her boot and tried to pull her from the saddle. It was the two lumberjacks.
"You're the greenie!"
one yelled at her. Fortunately, no one else could hear over the roar of the crowd.
"I heard that troll call you a Green Rider."
Kerrigan clung desperately to the horse's mane and gasped as she was pulled inch by inch out of the saddle. A well-placed kick from the horse, however, quickly ended the struggle, and one of the lumberjacks fell with a howl beneath the feet of the crowd. Kerrigan urged the horse on toward the bridge, heedless of people who got in her way. The horse did not trample them, but rather pushed them aside like the prow of a boat on the water. When she was clear of the mob, she galloped the horse over the bridge, his hooves clattering on the wooden deck, the river churning frothy and turbulent below, and sending up mist and spray that dampened her face. When finally she was across, and thus free of the town except for a few ramshackle shops and a tavern on this bank, she reined the horse in and looked back. It was impossible to discern exactly what was happening. The mob had become a single moving mass. She wondered what had become of the woman she had accused of being a Green Rider. She had done it not out of mischief, but to save herself. A mounted figure stood amidst the mob. A gray figure, fixed like a statue in the middle of a swift-running, roiling stream, unable to move forward or backward. Kerrigan felt cold, knowing with some certainty that he watched her from beneath his gray hood. Wild Ride. Kerrigan rode for 2 days, snatching moments of rest when she could no longer keep her eyes open. The landscape varied little. Tree stumps interspersed with staghorn sumac and tiny birches and maples, growing up where a vast spruce forest once stood. Many of the useless trees had been toppled to allow easier access to the more profitable ones. Their skeletons lay on the ground, bleached gray and dry by the sun. Kerrigan's skin burned, and she felt bleached and dry herself in the intense sunlight, without sheltering trees to offer shade. The scolding of squirrels and the spring songs of birds were eerily absent. She spent much of her time scanning the land. The horse track offered no concealment and anyone could be seen from a long way off. She tried to think of this as an advantage. Without concealment, a trap could not be set for her. She would be able to see her foes from far away. There was no telling how far it was to Sacker City. They came upon an ancient stone marker so weathered and splotched by lichen that it was impossible to read the inscription. They passed several teams of oxen hauling sledges piled high with logs, leaving plumes of dust in their wake, which could be seen miles away. Kerrigan coughed and gasped behind them, wishing she had a scarf to tie around her nose and mouth. The cargo masters paid her no heed, intent on the track ahead. She spent sleepless nights huddled beneath the greatcoat, the saber drawn and ready. There was no sign of pursuit, and this was somehow more disquieting. Did other green riders spend sleepless nights too, or were they used to the dangers of the road? On the third morning out of north, logged forests gave way to farmland. Fields checkered in spring green and deep brown loam rolled away in each direction. The air freshened and was less arid. Here, birds sang in hedgerows and the occasional trees, but the land still offered no cover. Farmers plowed on distant hills with their teams in plain view. Kerrigan continued her rigid pace, pausing long enough only for the horse to recover for another run. They found an abandoned barn netted by clinging grapevine and thorns to spend the night in. The barn leaned to one side in an attitude of collapse, but the grapevine, Kerrigan thought, ought to hold up for at least one more night. Under cover and out of sight, she slept soundly, not even flinching when bats left their roosts above where she lay, curled up in her bedroll. She didn't awaken when they returned from their hunt, or to the yips of coyotes ranging the countryside. The night world moved about her, but did not disturb her. In the morning, sunlight thrust between boards and broken windows like bright spears. Motes of dust drifted upwards in the light as she slipped tack and packs on the horse. Both messenger and messenger horse were better for their night of rest. Kerrigan peered through the old barn windows before stepping outside. If it had occurred to her that the barn was the only place that offered concealment in the area, and she had been in a less exhausted state, she would have abandoned it as too obvious. What was done, and no harm had come of it. No one was in sight except crows, which launched into flight as she led the horse from the barn. She mounted, and the race went on. That afternoon, a wood came into view. It wasn't the deep forest of the green cloak, but a young forest of slender birches, oaks, and maples. They had grown up in what had once been a farmer's field. A wall of field stones skirted the horse track and disappeared into the wood. Kerrigan approached it with both relief and apprehension. The wood offered cover, but also offered concealment for foes, the opposite of her previous problem. A breeze rustled leaves which whispered secrets among themselves. A figure in green appeared ahead, and she stiffened. He merged with the vegetation and disappeared. Freyan Kobelbay? When he appeared, dire things tended to happen. Kerrigan licked her dry, cracked lips. The sun was high and bright, glistening on leaves, turning them into emerald jewels. The shade within the wood beckoned her out of the hot sun, would soothe the sunburn that had afflicted her since leaving north. She could think of no place less sinister than the wood. She took a deep breath and plunged in. The shade cooled her down. It was like stepping into her father's wine cellar on the hottest of summer afternoons. A bee droned past her ear, and she inhaled the woody scents of decayed leaf litter and earth, much different than the evergreen scent of the northern forest she had left behind. Leaves thrashed like the sound of a bear charging through the woods. Kerrigan grabbed the hilt of her sword and looked wildly about. When she saw the source of the disturbance, she laughed nervously. A red squirrel. A squirrel stirring up the leaf litter. Her imagination was getting the better of her. But what was upsetting the horse? He sidestepped, his ears flopping back and forth. What's wrong? She had long since learned to trust his signals.
Hello, Greeny.
Kerrigan twisted around. Sitting motionless on their horses were Imerez and the gray-cloaked rider. She screamed inside. Imerez uncoiled his whip. Kerrigan reined the horse around to flee, but two mounted figures rode from the woods and blocked her path. Sarge and Thursgad. Where had they come from? Imerez leaned toward the gray-cloaked rider, the Shadow Man, listening as something was whispered to him. His one eye was anchored on Kerrigan, and his hands worked the whip as he listened. Kerrigan's hand went to her saber, but not soon enough.
"Drive her into the sunlight, boys!" Imerez shouted.
The soldiers charged her in a flurry of Morwellian scarlet, their swords drawn. Their steeds rammed into the horse, biting and pushing. Kerrigan fought to stay mounted as he half-reared and bucked, but the mere force of two against one was too much, and she found herself squinting in the sun. She reached for her brooch and wished for invisibility. The bright world became dull and heavy, and the Shadow Man faded from sight. Imerez laughed.
I see the greeny magic doesn't work so well in the bright light of day.
Kerrigan gasped as she looked down at herself and the horse. They were too solid, and somehow Imerez and the Shadow Man had known this would happen. She dropped the invisibility, maintaining it would only exhaust her. The Shadow Man reappeared. What did it mean? She veered the horse around, but Imerez and his men crowded her. The Shadow Man stayed aloof, watching from the depths of his hood. Bunchberry flower. Someone would come in need. Before she could even complete the thought, Imerez's thong snarled past her face and lashed around her chest and shoulders, gashing her left arm. She cried out. The leather thong tightened, and Imerez dug his spurs into the sides of his stallion. It leaped backward, and Kerrigan was hauled from her saddle. When she hit the ground, all the air whooshed from her lungs. She struggled dazedly against the binding thong, fighting waves of pain from the jarring impact of her fall. The whip held her fast.
Get the message satchel, boys.
Sarge and Thursgad hurried to obey their captain's command, but the horse wouldn't let them near. He kicked Thursgad's steed squarely in the chest. The unfortunate horse grunted and shied away. The horse backed from Sarge as if to flee, then swerved around and lunged at him in a rear.
Damn the beast!
Sarge pulled away unsuccessfully as the hooves of the horse collided with the shoulder of his bay, leaving behind shiny streaks of blood.
Hamstring him or cut his throat, the captain said. I don't care. Just get that message satchel. I'll help you, Sarge.
Thursgad kicked his horse, but it would only step backward. Sarge's horse now shied from the horse, who, with teeth bared, snorted aggressively.
Proud cut, I'll warrant, Sarge grumbled.
Kerrigan shook her head to clear her thoughts. Not an easy task with hooves flying just inches from her. The hilt of her sword was lodged beneath her hip. She wasn't disarmed yet. The horse would occupy Sarge and Thursgad, but she would have to deal with Imerez and the Shadow Man by herself. The horse lunged at Sarge again, and she was showered by clods of dirt and pebbles. The Shadow Man made a sweeping gesture with his hand. It was a white hand, perfectly proportioned, not the skeletal hand she had somehow imagined. Someone, living and breathing, was concealed beneath that hood. Imerez nodded in response to the gesture and clucked his horse backward. Kerrigan grit her teeth as the whip tightened around her, strangled her, cut into her flesh. He dragged her several yards across rocks and tall grasses, away from sharp horse hooves. He dismounted, and keeping the whip taut, stood above her. The sun glared behind him, and Kerrigan had to squint to see him.
"I don't know what kind of training you give your greeny horses, but my men will have him down shortly. No doubt about it."
His green eye flicked over at the action, then planted on Kerrigan again.
"What do you know about a spy in House Merwell?"
Kerrigan struggled to sit up, but he drove his boot heel into her shoulder and slammed her back into the ground. Her shoulder flashed with pain.
"Merwellians," she gasped. "Nothing but cutthroats."
There was no reply for a moment.
"I asked you a question."
Kerrigan craned her neck upward.
"I don't even know what the message is about. I don't know anything about anything. You understand?"
She was surprised by her own vehemence. Her voice did not sound high-pitched and frightened. Imrez squatted down out of the glare, which shifted the shadows on his face. Sweat gleamed on his bald head.
"I don't know how it is Freein Kobelbay passed his mission to you, but he did. You do know the information."
"I do not."
Imrez peered over his shoulder, and to the shadow man he said,
"I don't wish to play this game anymore."
There was no response. Only Sarge's curses could be heard down the track. When Imrez gazed back at Kerrigan, his features were tight.
"You could tell me about the spy now, and spare yourself some trouble."
"Does your statue friend make you do all his work?"
Imrez grinned humorlessly.
"He is no friend of mine."
"Then why? What's so important?"
Kerrigan wriggled her hand pinned beneath her body, reaching for the hilt of her sword. No one was here to help her. No Eagle, no Abram, no Barry sisters, no Elysian, no Ghost. Curious that Freein Kobelbay wasn't here to help, or at least to communicate. Perhaps his time walking the earth had expired. Imrez seemed perplexed by Kerrigan's questions.
"What do you mean, why? I'll wager you're trying to throw us off the track."
Sand and grit abraded Kerrigan's hand as she burrowed it beneath her body. She fixed her gaze on Imrez, so not to give away her intent.
"I'm not really a Green Rider. I don't care what's important to you, or what's important to King Zachary. I found the messenger dead and took his horse. I'm just trying to get home, nothing more. You can have the message if you want."
Imrez laughed and slapped his thigh. He looked over his shoulder at the shadow man.
"Did you hear that? She says we can have the message if we want."
The laughter stopped cold, and he gazed down at her.
"If that is so, call off the horse."
Kerrigan shrugged as best she could in the confines of the whip. Her fingertips touched cold metal.
The pommel.
"He doesn't listen to me."
"I thought so. If you're no Green Rider, you certainly look like one."
Kerrigan had slipped on the green trousers that morning.
"The clothes, they were in the messenger's pack."
Her fingers worked down the hilt, slowly tugging the sword from the sheath. A drop of sweat glided down to the tip of her nose and hung there. Imrez seized her by the jaw and lifted her from the ground to look her in the eye.
"No more lies," he hissed.
"Admit that you know of the Merwellian involvement. Tell us about the spy."
He released her jaw, and she fell to the ground with a solid thud, her grip on the saber lost.
"I know nothing about Freein Kobelbay or what he did. I am not a Green Rider. Merwell is a province of idiots anyway."
It sounded childish, and as the fury grew on Imrez's face, she was sure he would kill her.
"I don't care how young you look, Greeny," he said calmly.
There was no explosion, but somehow, this was worse.
"You shall be bound to a tree, and my whip will extract the information from you."
"Alone. I'm alone." The horse was tiring, and even now Sarge reached for his reins. Imrez towered over Kerrigan.
Stand up, Greeny.
Now. Now, or I won't have another chance. She climbed to her feet, gripping the hilt of her sword as she did so. Imrez gasped in surprise, tightening the whip too late. The leather thong unraveled from her shoulders, and she jumped to the attack. She was too close for Imrez to draw his own sword, but he ducked as she swung the saber at him, and double-fisted his hands into her stomach. She crouched over, holding her stomach and retching.
Foolish. Very foolish.
Imrez lashed his whip as slowly and deliberately as a cat would its tail.
Drop the sword.
Kerrigan's lungs ached for air. Blood thrummed through her ears. It was rhythmic, like the galloping of hooves.
You won't drop the sword, then?
Imrez flung the whip at her. It coiled around her ankle, and he jerked her foot out from under her. She crashed back to the ground. Kerrigan cried out. It was the same ankle the creature of Canmeran Vane had clenched in its claw. The sense of complete helplessness rushed back to her, and the memory of how she had overcome it to defeat the creature and its offspring. She chopped at the leather thong, but it was too thick to be severed completely through. Imrez threw back his head and laughed at her futile attempts. He loosened the whip, drew it away, and gathered it for another lash. I killed the creature of Canmeran Vane, Kerrigan thought. But I had help. Yet she would not allow Imrez to use the whip again. The crescendo of hoofbeats, heartbeats, thundered in her ears. She sprang to her feet with a growl, and this time she didn't hack at the whip, but at the hand that held the whip. She stopped, staring stupidly at the saber dripping blood, at Imrez groveling on the ground. His hand was several feet away, just like in the vision she had through Professor Barry's telescope. The hoofbeats in her head drowned out his screams. Horse! She cried, but he was already beside her, quivering with energy she did not understand. Sarge's and Thursgad's horses spooked at the air. Even the Shadow Man's mount pawed the ground, his neck foamy with sweat. Imrez's stallion had run away.
Mount!
The voice pierced through the hoofbeats drumming in her ears. She obeyed, and the world reeled out of balance. Thursgad and Sarge and their horses turned slowly, each movement prolonged and exaggerated, removed from real time. Everything blurred in Kerrigan's vision, except herself and the horse, and the Shadow Man. The Shadow Man sat serenely on his stallion. A bow appeared in his hands where there had been none before. He removed two arrows from his quiver, each black-shafted with red fletching. He knocked one to the bowstring.
Ride!
The voice commanded. Kerrigan dared not disobey. She squeezed the horse's sides just as the first arrow was loosed. The horse leaped into a gallop. Blue of sky, green and brown of wood, rushed by in streaks. The buildings of a village were a smear they left behind. Two arrows, she knew, sang behind her and would not stop till they found their mark. Wind buffeted her, loosened the braid in her hair. The rhythm of the horse's hooves pounded through her body, but for all she knew, they flew. There were other pounding hooves, other riders abreast of her, filmy white and transparent. Trees and buildings did not hinder them. They traveled right through. They called to her with far-off voices and what was like a battle cry. Ride, Greeny, ride! It is the wild ride! Cold arms slipped around her waist from behind.
Ride, Freean Coblebay whispered. It's the wild ride.
The more the landscape grew indistinct, the more the riders clarified. Men and women in great coats or tunics striding alongside, some in light armor of war astride battle steeds, and some in uniforms of archaic vintage riding lean messenger horses. All traveled at the same unnatural speed as she and the horse. All of them were green riders from times past. All of them dead. What stake did ghosts have in her survival?
Ride, Greenie, ride!
Their chant spun the world faster, and still the horse surged blindly ahead. Their pale faces were young, few were old. Some riders thrust their sabers above their heads, others shook their fists, their shouts echoed to her from some place far away. A cold sweat blanketed her body as she charged along with the ghostly cavalry. The arrows still followed behind with the same momentum, she knew. She could hear them whining through the air. How long could this wild ride last?
Ride, Greenie, ride! It's the wild ride!
The chant kept time with the rhythm of pounding hooves, of her heartbeat, of the blood pumping through her ears.
They burn!
At first, Kerrigan didn't know what Freyan meant. Did the spirits burn?
The arrows burn.
Kerrigan glanced over her shoulder, disconcerted at looking through Freyan's gauzy form. Indeed, the arrows were aflame and falling behind. A shout of victory, like a rush of wind, arose from the spirit riders. They pulled their horses to a halt, the horse slackening his gait without direction. Though all were stopped, the world still hastened by, as if they were being swept away on some spectral current.
Why?
Kerrigan asked. Freyan Kolbelbay slipped off the horse and backed away, melting into the others.
I cannot rest till you complete the mission.
His voice faded.
It was a good ride.
Why? Kerrigan demanded, the reins bunched in her fist. Why did you intervene? A lone rider broke away from the group, her long hair drifting in an unearthly breeze. Two arrows protruded from her chest. The rider Kerrigan had seen dead in North.
Joy. If this did not go beyond earthly matters, we would not have intervened. There is much you might accomplish to thwart the plans of an old evil. May we ride together again some day, Green Rider.
Joy turned her horse back among the other ghosts. The mass merged into itself, then lifted and dissipated like a fog carried off on a breeze to the heavens. Still, the rhythm of the wild ride pulsed in Kerrigan's ears. Ride's End. The world slowed down, though colors still smeared like water on paint. A massive stone structure of towers and parapets and crenellated walls loomed ahead with colorful pennants streaming from its loftiest heights. An arched entryway flanked by rounded turrets gaped before her. Behind her stood the guardhouses, the portcullis suspended between them, ready to cut off an invasion should an army attempt to swarm across the narrow drawbridge spanning the moat and assault the castle. A wall encircled the castle and its grounds. Somehow, the ghosts had carried her miles in just moments to the courtyard, where she now stood before the castle of King Zachary. The horse's hooves crunched on gravel. She dismounted and, hands shaking, unbuckled the message satchel from the saddle. She left the horse standing there, no worse from his strange run. Time lagged again, and Kerrigan swayed as if the ground moved beneath her feet. The pennants, each representing the provinces, snapped into definition. Though their lines were no longer blurred, their motion was jerky and slow. When her footing grew solid again, she proceeded to walk the distance across the courtyard to the castle entrance. Guards in black and silver stepped forward with halting movements to intercept her. They had not managed two steps by the time she was far beyond their reach. As she walked beneath the arched entryway, more soldiers attempted unsuccessfully to stop her in jerk and stagger movements. They were too slow. She was too fast. Their voices were muffled, the words drawn out in a moronic drone. She strode through a great corridor past guards and courtiers stalled in time. Most did not note her passage. Lamps lit along the walls flickered absurdly slow, casting a wash of strange tones of bronze and gold along the corridor. The corridor, she hoped, led to King Zachary's throne. Coats of arms and weavings adorned the walls, and these remained static and clearly defined. She focused on these things rather than the unnatural, disorienting motions of the people around her. Two doors appeared ahead of her, open. Some huge oak tree had been felled to create them. The firebrand was carved into one, and the crescent moon in the other. Two guards clad entirely in black were posted beside the doors. They were weapons, but even they weren't immune to the time anomaly. She swept past them and through the doors into a vast chamber. Sunlight lanced through tall and narrow windows at cross slants. Voices echoed off the vaulted ceiling in a weird and long-drawn-out babble. Black-clad guards stood like pillars in shadowy recesses. A tapestry of Zachary's family crest, a white Hillander terrier against a field of heather, occupied the space behind the throne. It was said that the brave little dogs had rooted ground mites out of their earthen burrows during the long war. Below the tapestry stood two men and a woman attending a man who sat in an ornate chair. A white terrier sat up from where it had been lying at the seated man's feet. Before it was on its feet, Kerrigan had crossed the cavernous room. The three people and the king were just beginning to look up at her. Slam! Like walking into a wall, like the ground being pulled out from beneath her feet, the force rocked through her body, and she fell away piece by piece, like feathers from a burst pillow cascading in a soft flurry. She lay in a field immersed in sunlight. Sunlight leaked through her closed eyes. Asters and goldenrod droned with bees lighting from one blossom to another. A swallow chirped somewhere above her. She felt warm and drowsy. The light. Something cool and wet ran along her cheek. Time and motion snicked into place, like the latching of a door. Kerrigan shook her head, willing the stinging drone of bees and shock of light to leave her. She sighed, closed her eyes, and settled down to continue her nap. But the cool, wet something now licked her hand. She cracked open an eye. A pair of brown eyes gazed back at her from beneath a clump of white fur. The terrier panted and looked at her with a grin. Kerrigan widened her eyes. Dog! Kessel! Zachary! She sat up too fast and spiraled back down to the woolen runner in front of the king's dais. The buzz filled her head again, but it might have been the voices of people around her. This time when she looked up, four blades wielded by black-clad weapons were pointed at her chest.
"This is no Green Rider I've ever seen before,"
a man's voice with a hard edge to it.
"Could it be another assassin?" the woman asked.
"Her coming here smells of magic," said a second man with a sniff.
Kerrigan had fallen on the message satchel. She rolled to her side to unwedge it, and the weapons pressed the tips of their blades against her chest.
"Message."
Kerrigan's mouth felt too full of tongue.
"Message for the king."
"Let us see it," said the first man.
Kerrigan took the paper from the satchel and handed it to a weapon, who in turn passed it to someone she could not see. Indistinct murmurings echoed off the walls of the cavernous room, which seemed rather like whispers issuing from the fresco-painted figures on the ceiling. The age-cracked figures of kings, queens, knights, and the god Eric, riding the sickle moon, and the goddess Orion, haloed by the sun and peering from behind a cloud, all looked down on her. Among them, and at the center, was a great black horse whose arched neck and flanks rippled with motion.
"Spy," a queen seemed to say from above.
"This message is from Freon Kobelbe, but this is," said the king.
"Unimportant and irrelevant. It's the magic I'm
too young to be.
Should be confined and interrogated. Unimportant."
Kerrigan drifted away again in search of the sunlit field, but she was not able to find it. The weapons seized her roughly under her arms and hauled her to her feet. Someone took away the saber. She protested weakly, but no one heard.
Lock her up until we decide.
Not in a prison cell, said a gentler voice Kerrigan hadn't heard before.
The weapons blocked her view with their broad shoulders, and she could not see who spoke.
Choose a guest room, and guard it.
But, Majesty, said the harsh voice, you may be endangering yourself. This one uses magic like we've never seen before.
And all the prison cells in the world would not hold her if she did, anyway. A guest room. Does she look threatening to you in her present condition, Crow?
Majesty, begging your pardon, but she may just want it to look that way.
Of all the idiotic ideas I've ever heard, that is the worst, said a new voice from the direction of the entryway. It belonged to a woman accustomed to authority. The weapons still blocked Kerrigan's view, but she heard the purposeful click of boots on the flagstone floor as the woman approached. She passed by, and the clicking ceased. Your Majesty.
Captain, your intrusion speaks of...
Disrespect, Castellan Crow. Is that what you wish to say?
I will not have this bickering, said the king. Captain Mapstone, do you have anything you wish to say? Do you know this girl? She dresses as a Green Rider.
I have never laid eyes on her before, but I think I can tell you who she is. The woman stood on tiptoes and peered over the shoulders of the weapons. Kerrigan received a fleeting impression of hazel eyes and reddish hair. I can also tell you that she is a Green Rider.
No,
Kerrigan whispered, but no one was listening.
I can't say I understand, Captain,
Crow said.
Your Majesty, have her taken to Rider Barracks. She will do you no harm. And if I'm not mistaken, the message you hold in your hands is of great import.
We have our doubts about that,
the king said.
Then what of this?
The captain held aloft two black arrows. Kerrigan groaned and lurched to her side, and would have fallen if not for the support of the weapons. The two weapons led her away from the throne, each stony-faced and silent. They passed through alternating shafts of dazzling sunlight and shadow as they walked to the far end of the throne room. Had Torn and Jandara once been this way, stern and silent? Courtiers, servants, and soldiers who walked the corridors spared her a glance, not at all. They left the castle by a different entrance than she had come in, and passed through a courtyard skirting the castle. The weapons gripped her elbows, practically lifting her from the ground as they escorted her past curious onlookers. They brought her to a whitewashed wooden building, the unmistakable odor of horse manure permeating from a not-too-distant source. The people here were all dressed in green, and they were very curious. They stared at her.
Where am I? She asked.
Rider Barracks, the weapon to her left said, and that was all.
They entered the building, floorboards creaking beneath their feet, and a hint of leather in the air. It was far more appealing than the stone castle. Abruptly, they stopped, and the weapon to her right threw open a door. They shuffled her into a room sparsely furnished with a bed, table, washstand, stove, and chair. Sunlight poured through a window, warming the place.
You will empty your pockets, said the weapon who had been at her right.
The other stepped out of the room and posted himself by the door. I will what?
Empty your pockets.
The man lacked any hint of emotion. Kerrigan tossed the message satchel on the table. Somehow she had managed to hold on to it, and dug into her pockets. She produced the moonstone, some coppers and one silver, the bunchberry flower with its missing petal, the sprig of bayberry, and Joy's winged horse brooch. The weapon gathered her things up into one large hand.
The ring, he said.
No, you can't have it. She covered it protectively. The weapon stepped forward.
The ring. Until your identity and purpose is ascertained, we will hold these things.
No, not the ring. All of these things, all except the brooch, were gifts. This ring was my mother's. I won't give it to you. The weapon took another step toward her, his face implacable. Kerrigan stooped into a defensive crouch.
The gods help you if you take a step closer. I've about had it. All I've done is deliver a message to the king,
yet all I get in thanks is trouble. Well, I'll tell you, Granite Face, I've killed one of your kind, and if you take another step, I'll do my utmost to damage you.
That stopped him, though the threat didn't seriously concern him. He didn't even bother to draw his blade.
I doubt you could hurt any of us. If so, who was it?
In a measured breath, she said, his name was Torn. The weapon's brows knit together, and his eyes flashed angrily.
Torn, a traitor of Savaril's ilk. A deserter.
Keep your ring, then. These other objects will be returned to you if it's found you are not lying.
With that, he turned crisply on his heel and glided out of the room, closing the door behind him. Kerrigan supported herself against the table, her knees ready to buckle. What possessed her to challenge a weapon? When she had killed Torn, Freyan was in control of her body. She staggered across the small room to the bed and collapsed. Straw poked through the mattress ticking, but it felt, for all the world, like a feather bed to her overtaxed body. A noise awakened Kerrigan. Someone was in the room bending over her bed, and it was too dark to see who. She reached out into the gloom and grabbed a handful of hair. Her assailant squeaked. Kerrigan tugged harder.
Ow, stop it! A girl cried out. I'd like to keep my hair if you don't mind.
Kerrigan shook her head. The room was dimly lit by an oil lamp at lowest glow. Orange flickered around the edges of the stove door, and the room, she noticed, was quite cozy. She had slept well into the night. Her assailant was a girl of about 12 years old, dressed in messenger green. Her hands were on her hips, and her feet were spread apart. And to Kerrigan, it was like facing one of her own strong-willed aunts.
You won't finish dinner, eh?
She remembered. Aunt Stace wouldn't let her eat dinner for the next 2 nights.
Sorry, Kerrigan said. She let a handful of brown hair drift to the floor. The girl's stance relaxed.
I'll accept your apology. Most riders are jumpy anyway.
The girl's name, Kerrigan found out, was Melry Exeter, and she had been in the midst of checking on Kerrigan's condition.
The nitwits around here don't have the head to take care of anything.
Melry cleaned and bandaged the whip wound Imriz had inflicted on Kerrigan's shoulder.
Look in on her, says the captain. Well, what a mess I did find. You look like Condor dragged you all the way from Selium. Are you sure you were in the saddle?
Condor?
Yeah. Freyan's horse.
Kerrigan had grown so used to calling him the horse that she had forgotten he might answer to another name. Condor fit, though. Condors were not the most beautiful of birds, but they had the capacity for elegant flight. Kerrigan looked up at Melry's face and was surprised to see tears trickling down her cheeks. What's wrong?
Freyan's dead, isn't he? That's why you came on Condor, right?
Kerrigan nodded.
Yes, he asked me to carry on his mission. Melry wiped her nose with the back of her sleeve and sat in the chair.
They told me, but I couldn't believe it till I saw Condor. Freyan's the closest thing I ever had to a brother. He played games with me, kept an eye on me, let me tag after him around the castle.
I'm sorry, Kerrigan said. She knew it was inadequate, but it was what everyone had said when her mother died.
Yeah, I knew it might happen sometime. I try not to get real close to the people round here 'cause they die. It hurts. Captain and Freyan are the only ones I got close to.
They sat in silence for some time. Aren't you a little young to be a Green Rider? Kerrigan asked. Everyone seemed to think she was too young, and this girl was even younger. Melry laughed, the tears miraculously drying.
I'm too young. You're too young. I was raised here.
Here? Kerrigan crooked a brow, disbelieving.
Yeah, here. Captain found me in the stable. I was a newborn, all wrapped in a blanket. Someone, my real mother, left me in the stable.
Melry shrugged at the illogic of such an act.
They think my father was a rider who got killed months before. He had a reputation with women. Captain took me in, named me after her grandmother, and she and the other riders raised me. I'm not a proper green rider. I just help out at the stable and sometimes I run messages for the Greenfoot.
The Greenfoot?
Yeah. We run messages around the castle. Gives me a few coppers for fair days and Master Gruntler's sugary. But I imagine I'll be a green rider when I get older.
What would it be like to know one's destiny? Kerrigan had always thought she would be a merchant like her father, but was now certain that she had never really known. I'm sure you know what it's like to be a green rider. Melry gave her a sideways look.
I'm sure you do, too.
What?
Are you hungry?
You're kind of pale. What do you mean I'd know what it's like to be a green rider?
You have a brooch, don't you? I can't see it proper because I'm not a green rider yet, but you have a brooch. That makes you a green rider.
A brooch doesn't make me anything.
Whatever you say. You want some food? After that, it's off to the bath for you.
Kerrigan perked up. Bath? Melry chuckled and slipped out of the room. Shortly, she returned, bearing a platter of steaming meat and potatoes, cheese and bread. In her other hand, she carried a mug of fresh milk. She watched in amazement as Kerrigan all but licked the platter.
Your color's coming back, she said.
Kerrigan swallowed the last of the milk and wiped the milk mustache off with her sleeve. Today, drain me. Melry leaned forward with an expression of deadly seriousness that only near teenagers can achieve.
There have been rumors flying around all day about you. Like, you did something today that no one's done in a million years. Or was it 1,000?
Melry screwed up her face.
I'm not real good with numbers. Frustrates the captain a lot. Is it true?
I've no idea, Kerrigan said. But I did have a strange day.
What happened?
How could she tell this girl that she had ridden with the ghost of her friend, Frian Kobelbe, not to mention the ghosts who were among the first to be green riders? I don't feel up to discussing it. Melry's face crumbled in disappointment.
Well, they said you traveled fast, whatever that means. Condor is fast, but not the fastest. That would be Iriel's crane. Anyway, it's off to the bath for you.
Kerrigan followed Melry out of the room. A weapon whom she hadn't seen before fell in step behind them. Melry rolled her eyes. The few riders they encountered in the corridor goggled at Kerrigan as if she were some unknown creature from another land, but said nothing. One young man with sandy hair actually smiled at her and said, "Welcome, rider."
"That was Alton,"
Melry said after he passed by.
"He's always full of himself. Aristocratic blood, you know, but not a bad sort."
A steaming hip bath awaited Kerrigan in the bathing room. Several other baths were partitioned off by curtains, but the room was empty of other people. She stepped toward the bath, then hesitated, glancing at the weapon. Melry followed her eyes and put her hands on her hips.
"You mind watching things from outside, Fashion? Give Kerrigan a little privacy, will you? If you want to see a naked woman, go downtown."
Kerrigan's eyes widened that Melry would speak to a weapon so, but Fastian's expression did not alter as he stepped outside of the room.
"I haven't decided whether or not weapons are a natural phenomenon," Melry said,
pronouncing the last word with special care.
"The captain says that a lot."
Kerrigan smiled, something her facial muscles were no longer used to.
"Thanks, Melry." "Only the captain calls me Melry. You can call me Mel if you like."
She left the bathing chamber, whistling. Kerrigan sank into the tub, her battered and bruised body easing in the heat. She nodded off and woke up with a snort to discover she had dozed long enough for the water to become tepid. With a shiver, she stepped out of the bath, toweled herself dry, and dressed. Tentatively, she opened the door and found Fashion waiting patiently for her outside. "I'm done." He nodded, and they headed down the corridor. They arrived at the room simultaneously with Mel, who could hardly see over an armload of green clothes.
"Thought you might need a change of clothes," she said. "So I stopped at the quartermaster's. He wasn't happy about being woke up so late, nor about giving up good uniforms."
Fashion took up his post outside, and Melry dumped the load on Kerrigan's bed.
"Hope it fits, and I hope you don't mind green."
Kerrigan sighed, lamenting her wardrobe left in Selium so long ago. "I'm getting used to it." She held a familiar linen shirt to her shoulders for size.
I think this will work. I borrowed some things from the way station near North. Mel's eyes grew large.
You were there? That's wild territory.
Kerrigan nodded. I read a notice that the quartermaster was to be informed when things are taken. Mel listened attentively while Kerrigan listed the uniform pieces she had removed from the way station. When Kerrigan finished, Mel yawned.
I'll take care of it in the morning. Quartermaster'll skin me if I wake him up again. I'm about done in myself, anyway. Have to get up early to feed the horses.
Kerrigan's eyes fell on the message satchel still lying on her table. One more thing, she said. Free and Cobblebay wrote a letter to Lady Astora. Would you mind delivering it to her? Mel's eyes nearly bugged out of her head.
Oh, no! Astora, she doesn't know about Freean yet.
Then best she hears it from you, and not a total stranger like me. Kerrigan took the letter from the satchel and passed it to Mel, feeling a great deal of self-satisfaction. She had achieved her mission, had delivered the king his message, and even the love letter, and she was still alive.
I'll take it.
Tears threatened to spill down Mel's cheeks again.
You're right. Best she hears it from me.
Mel left, and Kerrigan sagged in exhaustion to the bed. She kicked off her boots and wrapped a blanket around herself, and fell asleep as soon as her head touched the pillow.
Stevic Glavian.
Like old times, isn't it?
Stevic Glavian poked a stick at the crackling campfire.
Just the two of us on the road without an inn in sight.
Savanna grunted from where he lay on his bedroll, with his hands folded across his belly.
Aye. Well, you ought to be home, looking over accounts, or at the very least, leading one of your caravans.
The night was thick in this unpopulated countryside, and the piercing glimmer of stars above, cold and distant. To the gods watching from above, would their little campfire appear as a point of light, like a star? Not even a farmer's cot could be found for miles along this forsaken stretch of road, denying them even the homey glow of a candle in a window. They were alone, he and Savanno, with the night and the gods. Stevic rested his arms on his knees.
Do you suppose she has spent many nights like this?
Savanno grunted again. He knew to whom his chief referred without asking.
Kerry is a bold lass. A little dark is nothing to her.
Stevic pulled his cloak over his shoulders and remained silent for a while, listening to the hiss and pop of the fire. He allowed the dancing tongues of flame to draw his gaze inward. He said,
I can't just sit at home reviewing accounts, you know. Nor can I lead a caravan. How do you expect me to do that?
Savanno sighed.
I don't, but this delay will cost you profit. What is a loss of profit compared to my daughter? Nothing,
Savanno said.
If it were, you would not be you, and I would not follow you.
Stevic chuckled.
Old fool, old friend. More than a cargo master you are to me. If anyone can find Kerry, it will be you.
When they had reached Corsa after their trip to Selium, Stevic learned the disquieting news that no one had seen Kerrigan, and that she hadn't come home before them. He commenced to spread the word among his people that Kerrigan was missing, and he bade them keep watch for her on the road while they set out on trading missions. The word was spread among other merchants and their staffs as well. It was not long before all of Corsa had heard that the heir to the great Glavian fortune was missing. Rumor spoke of kidnappers, and some mean-spirited persons had even sent letters demanding ransom for her return. Stevic had followed up on each, but discovered them all to be lies. All lies that delayed him from finding his daughter. Eventually Stevic and Savanno discarded the rumors as speculation, and left Corsa abuzz. They set out for Sacker City and would look for Kerrigan along the way. When they reached the city, they would look up Captain Mapstone and see if she had any news of Kerrigan. Stevic left the fire and stretched out on his own bedroll.
We've a few more days on the road, he said.
Oddly, he looked forward to reaching Sacker City, and dreaded it at the same time. He looked forward to sparring with that fiery Captain Mapstone. Quick, she was. Quick to anger, quick of wit. She had a bright, burning intelligence he found intriguing. He dreaded reaching Sacker City because of the news he might find there, the news he most feared. He feared he might find that Kerrigan was still missing, or worse, if found, was dead. Savano snored softly on the other side of the campfire. Stevic could not sleep. Instead, he gazed long and hard at the distant stars and wondered about the capricious gods who inhabited them. If the gods existed, why was his daughter missing? Visitor to the Realm. Laren Mapstone sat at the base of the king's dais with his advisors, the honorable counselors Sparren and Devon, and Castellan Crow. The crusty Sparren jabbered aimlessly about supposed civilians who disguised themselves as green riders and foolishly risked their lives to deliver unimportant messages to the king. The discussions had been grinding round in circles for hours now, and night coated the tall windows like black enamel. Pages had come by an hour ago to light wall lamps and candles ensconced in wooden chandeliers. In the flickering light, the figures painted on the ceiling appeared alive, their expressions severely disapproving of those down below them. They were like ghosts who watched. Finder, fast asleep at his master's feet, yipped and peddled his paws in some doggy dream of chasing hares. At least he'd had some dinner and a good stiff walk. The kennel master had seen to that. Laren's stomach growled. Even Finder's raw horse meat began to sound appetizing, and she would pay with a rotten backache for sitting in this second-age stiff chair, probably created specifically to torture advisors.
"We can't just have civilians dressing up," Sparren droned on, "as servants of the realm."
Blah, 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 Laren thought. The king sat preoccupied in his chair, his brown eyes distant, one leg across the other, his chin on his hand. He was crowned by a delicate silver fillet, which he regarded, she knew, as more of a collar than a symbol of his kingship. His beard made him appear older, wiser, but Laren knew a tired young man was behind the beard. Crumpled in his lap lay the all-important message. At least, it should have been important. Laren wondered what world the king's mind traveled in, for he seemed disinclined to participate in the discussion, rather, the bickering, of his advisors. He was probably walking the hills of his ancestral land with his dogs capering about him, where he could hear the rumble of the sea and the cries of gulls, and feel the free wind on his face. That was where he would be now, if his father had not astounded all by naming him heir to the realm. Zachary had protested exhaustively, as he had planned to govern Hillander Province and raise dogs, while his brother did the dirty work of managing the realm. In the end, King Amagast had seen through Prince Hamilton, however. He had seen how the spoiled child had grown into a spoiled man, who possessed not a single iota of leadership. The prince's mercurial temper was reflected in bruised servants, abused bed partners, and too many fine horses that had to be put down. Zachary wouldn't let his brother near the dogs. Everyone knew Hamilton's nature, but said nothing, for his father saw only the charming side of his son. And Prince Hamilton could be charming indeed. Then, a delegation from the Cloud Islands had come to Sacaridia to negotiate trade agreements. The relationship between the two countries had never been very secure, and King Amagast sought friendship with the islands, knowing it would make Sacaridia a leader in commerce. Prince Hamilton raped the daughter of one of the delegates, a girl hardly in her teens. When Prince Hamilton's act was discovered, the trade negotiations fell into shambles. The king finally listened to the whisperings around him, the whisperings of his son's indiscretions. Horrified that one of his own flesh was capable of such abuse, he began to look to his other son, Prince Zachary, the workhorse, the son who, while his father was occupied fruitlessly teaching Prince Hamilton the principles of kingship, excelled at his studies, learned about managing a province, and traveled to familiarize himself with the countryside and its people. When King Amagast chose Zachary to be his heir, Everyone breathed a sigh of relief. Almost everyone. Prince Hamilton, soured and seething hate after the loss of the throne, had returned to Hill.